catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
Vraiment, il faut que cette guerre-là, elle cesse.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children. And there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Afghanistan is now battling an invisible foe that threatens its future generations. The World Food Program has sounded the alarm on the rising tide of malnutrition cases, a crisis worsened by the country's ongoing economic challenges and reduced international aid. Marking the World Health Day, the Taliban's Minister of Public Health expresses concern over the malnutrition crisis, calling for international support.
It is clear that Afghanistan is one of the poor countries in the world. There is no doubt that children and mothers are grappling with malnutrition. We need the support of the world in combating the disaster. I call on the UNICEF, WHO and WFP to continue their assistance to our people with poor health conditions, especially those suffering from malnutrition.
The impact of international sanctions and the U.S. policies cannot be overlooked in understanding the gravity of the situation. That is a warning by pediatricians here in Afghanistan. Years of conflict have severely damaged the country's infrastructure, making it a challenge to provide adequate health care and nutrition to vulnerable groups. Moreover, recent cuts in international assistance as well as the Western-led sanctions are worsening things.
There are also some foreign factors exacerbating the malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. Afghan assets that belong to Afghans and are meant to support our economy are frozen. We are witnessing a decline in international health assistance, especially to our children. Some international bodies continue to collaborate, but these are not sufficient. Some organizations that used to support families have ended their missions in Afghanistan.
Lots of people like me are coming to this hospital because their children are malnourished. I think everything boils down to a single problem, economic shortcoming. If our family had enough to eat, our children wouldn't become undernourished. People don't have money and they're not receiving aid anymore.
Experts emphasize that the need for immediate aid cannot be overstated. Afghan families are in desperate need of assistance to combat this malnutrition crisis. The international community must come together to provide the necessary resources and support to save lives and alleviate the suffering of the Afghan people. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is taking a toll on the health and well-being of the war-ravaged nation. Advocates warn that without a significant increase in support, the crisis will further deepen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thousands of Austrians marched under the slogan "Stop the genocide, stop the occupation" in the capital Vienna. The Palestine Committee and Palestine Solidarity Austria organized the demonstration. The march was held on Saturday, a week after house raids of Palestinian activists in the city of Linz. Police recently also interrogated protesters in other cities. International Quds Day was an aspiration for the organizers of Saturday's protest.
And all these commemoration days is to really say, wake up, we are really in the situation where people are getting killed every day and we have to stop it as soon as possible.
Organizers also criticized a four-day visit of the President of the Austrian Parliament, Wolfgang Sobotka, to Israel this week.
Well, obviously, when looking at the last 6 months, there's been some unconditional support for Israel, obviously, and their action in the Gaza Strip, which is absolutely unacceptable.
Several speakers stressed Austrian solidarity with Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war continues unabated. They said the Austrian government does not speak for them.
It's the most obvious wrongdoing that I've ever seen in my life.
The protesters called for support for Lebanon and Yemen against US imperialist aggression. People from around the world joined the Vienna march.
I was born in Chile under a dictatorship and I have a lot of Palestinian friends. I am even wearing a t-shirt from a team called Palestina, who was founded by Palestinian migrants several years ago. I couldn't be in peace with myself if I wasn't here demonstrating and saying and raising my voice, at least.
Representatives of Jewish organizations such as Not In Our Name stressed their continued solidarity with the Palestinian struggles. Organizers said all Austrians must continue to protest against the US-Israeli genocide and their government support for it, despite the repression.
We cannot call ourselves humans, regardless of our nationalities or political views or religions, and be indifferent about what's going on nowadays in Gaza.
Thousands marched in the Austrian capital Vienna in support of the people and the resistance in Gaza as the Israeli genocide war claims more civilian lives. Despite Austria's repression, the state and the police were unable to stop the Palestine solidarity movement. Saturday's demonstration has once again shown that the support for Gaza remains strong in Austria. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and teenagers, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed light on this important subject. Salaamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So, another question we have over here is that, why is it important for a teenager to talk about their feelings? If you could expand on that.
Yes, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. It's for a variety of reasons that in teenagers especially should discuss about their feelings, what they have. They shouldn't, you know, vent up what they feel so that they can let out in a bad way. For example, watching too many movies or going with some friends or going out and loitering, you know, in the park, or even sometimes bad habits for boys like smoking. Because they've vented inside themselves those feelings and they can't let out to anyone. So first of all, that communication gap shouldn't be there. So to have a healthy outlet of release is to talk about it. So sometimes it involves even talking about people. But you know, Islam allows that if you talk about people for the sake of the fact that you want to, you know, like resort yourself, you want to improve yourself, or you want to know where you went wrong, then you can mention those things, for example, to a person you can confide in. And there can be none better than a mother or a parent who understands these laws of Islam and knows that there is no, like, you know, backbiting done over it. It's just to make them feel when where they went wrong.
True.
And probably if there was some solution to it. So this is the best and most healthy outlet to release the stress and the anxiety.
Yeah, and I think what you just said, like, stress is something that's really killing the youth right now. And a lot of them, like a lot of my friends said that because of all the stress that they are bottling up, it's really making them, you know, release it in the wrong ways. And they said they can't help it. But some of my friends became Muslims and they said after, you know, seeing how we have Allah and how we have Islam that kind of caters for all of this, they show this relationship that's supposed to be made between a family. They say that we never knew this, we never heard of this, and we feel like it's so strong in, especially in these Islam. Muslim communities, which is so special.
It's all because of those laws that have integrated inside their countries that make them feel that they are so free now. True. They can even leave their homes, they can even complain in the courts. They don't know that this is such a healthy outlet, right?
Definitely.
So another reason why talking about feelings is necessary is, you know, when a person, a teenager especially, verbalize their feelings, they know it what is with clarity what they're feeling. Because it's not like a jumbled thing in your head. You know, sometimes like some things are going on in your life, but you don't know, you mix them all up. So when you want that communication to happen, you, a teenager will know themselves for clarity. What is it that they are facing at that point in time? They won't mix it up in their mind. And the mind is such a thing that, you know, so many things can get inside at one go. But verbally, when you're expressing, it's just one thing at a time, right? So they themselves will know with clarity what they're facing, and then you can help them and get rid of the root cause and come to terms with those feelings and emotions that they're facing.
Definitely.
So this is why one reason that we have to you know, emphasize this communication and emphasize for them to let out their feelings. It's very important, especially for a girl.
Definitely. So we're just going to pause briefly and resume in a moment.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing about one of the questions that a parent had, which was, why is it important for a teenager to talk about their feelings? And you have said some very interesting points, some of which were, you know, if they bottle up too much, they end up, you know, falling astray, releasing it in the wrong places. And when you express verbally, it very much clears your mind, which is so important, especially for a youth.
That's right. Another of the reason is that parents could help as elders and guides to the teenagers for support and guidance, which the teenagers need most. And the teenagers, if they trust the parents, they would get the most support and guidance from parents more than even their peers and their age mates.
Definitely.
Friends would lend a help, like a listening ear. But would they be able to guide and support? Support is a very, important thing in a teenager's life. That one who is like a backbone for you.
True.
Wanting you to go through that. As far as financial support is concerned, example, any support that, one needs at that time in a crucial moment, friend would do it in a very limited way. But the parents are the best supporters. So to open up that conversation with the teenager and to let them out to talk about it is very important. That is the starting of it. So that you can support and guide the teenager and not let her, go astray, go for guidance somewhere else, or more so sometimes even go to a psychiatrist, where you have to end up spending more when they get so much stress in the long run that they can't handle their own situation. It comes to a point in time that you have to take them to the psychiatrist, which is a big issue in every way. You have to combat with it, you have to come in terms with it. Whilst if you go and see the mother, is the best psychiatrist if she knows what she's doing and she goes about it in the way that Islam says, going about it in a very delicate, fruitful, compassionate manner.
Definitely.
To get positive results out of it.
And also, I feel, especially teenagers today, they don't like when you kind of attach yourself too much to them, or when they feel like, okay, everything I'm doing is being watched, so I feel like there has to be a very good balance over here where parents show that they really care, they really support, but it's not like they're coming in the way every time or they're going time watching everything. So, that balance.
So that respecting of their privacy is important.
Exactly.
At the same time, watching over is very important.
Yeah.
That why do they feel what they're feeling now? Why have they bottled up so much? So to create that atmosphere of, light atmosphere so that they can feel like talking is to make them happy first, in the first instance, to do what is good for them, to make them feel lighthearted, that this is now maybe cooking their favorite meal, taking them out for a walk, buying something for them as a gift. So that will open them up so what they would like or need. They would feel that somebody loves me and they understand. And then they would, of course, naturally talk about their feelings.
Yeah.
And this is when one should guide and support them.
True. Even
tell
like
them very politely that this is what the consequence will be if this happens. Or guide them that, or support them. For whatever they want to embark upon, support them.
Exactly. So let's just have a short break and we'll continue shortly.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we've been discussing about Islamic upbringing. And one of the questions that we were discussing was why it's important for teenagers to talk about their feelings. And you said one of the last points you mentioned was parents can be guides and supports, while you won't find that in everybody. Mostly parents can be that support. Yeah.
Another thing is adolescents and teenagers sometimes can be very isolating. They can be very aloof and lonely. And sometimes we can misunderstand them also. So we should not misunderstand them. We should know that this is like a natural process of growing up. That isolation and loneliness. We should respect them at the same time. And we should always offer that, support and feeling that they, you are ready for to hear them out, and also ensure that they are not alone in this experience. So sometimes to feel that somebody is also sharing that thing what you are going through right now, you are not alone in that experience. For example, a girl might fail her high school, and she might not be able to go to the university, and she has to probably do one more year to go through the exams and everything. So a parent, if they are bold enough and they are also compassionate enough, they would say that even we went through this.
Yeah.
We didn't probably make it through, but we were still studious enough to do it the next few years. Or maybe we left a gap in between, and we went through another thing, for example, studying something that we loved, not just studying at random anything that just, you know, suits the curriculum of the time.
Yeah.
No, whatever you love. And who said that, for example, as far as this is concerned, this discussion of passing your exam or something, who said that this is the only way to show your talent? There are so many people who fail exams, but they are so talented people. So we should, you know, like remind them that they are not alone in their experience. Be that whatever, illness. Illness is, so many people are suffering. Maybe a girl is maybe having epilepsy or something like that.
Yeah.
We should remind them that people are worse off than that, and people are still moving along. So this is not lecturing. This is remindance in a very cool way, so that the teenager can feel that, yeah, it's not only me. So, you know, just as you feel that you have some company, whatever you are sharing, and people are worse off than you, you feel a bit heartened. You feel a bit better.
Yeah, you feel situation. Like I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I'm not the only one who feels sad, and who feels a sense of failure, or who feels that they don't have friends.
And there are
so many people who pass along this kind of phases, but yet they come out as winners in the end.
Definitely. And I think, you know, Islam is so special that we kind of constantly are getting reminded that we have a special goal to reach. And the more trials and tribulations we, you know, we go through, we suffer, there is something greater waiting for us over there. And although this is difficult to explain to teenagers, I just remember just knowing this concept in general was really helping me in my life. There was a time where I had to get, you know, a surgery done, and I felt like, you know, for a while life seemed so bleak. But just my mom would keep on reminding me about these kind of simple instances, not pushing it, and I would just feel at peace for a while that, you know, there is somebody over there watching over me, which knows my situation, knows my position, and I feel like that was very special.
Yeah, and that's like, lucky are those teenagers who have such parents like yours, inshallah. We pray that all teenagers have your kind of parents. In this day and age, you know, life is going on so fast, and parents don't even have time, you know, sometimes for their children to express so much. And that's why parents, if they are home, they have time to reflect upon the problems of their children.
Definitely.
It's an ideal situation when the parents have more time for their children rather than outside, right?
Yeah, Asant. Thank you so much. This was very fruitful, and thank you so much for your valuable time, and we hope to see you in the next one. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. You've just listened to IRIB English Radio. And if you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI, Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Day 190 of the U.S.-Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, and the devastation has taken a turn for the worse. This is in reference to the city of Khan Yunis as an example. Near total destruction. Reason? Massive arms and bombs provided by countries like the U.S. and the U.K., who have said it cannot stop arms sales to the Israeli regime. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the depth of the genocidal war in all of its aspects, the worldwide pro-Palestine solidarity protest, and why hopes were dashed again for Palestinians' quest for statehood, even though there are many countries eager to support Palestinian statehood. First, let me introduce our guests. Mick Napier joins us from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh. Also joining us is Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, who joins us from Manchester. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Mick Napier, if I may start with you, and let's look at the UK arms sales and what the UK has said, that it's not going to suspend its arms exports to Israel. Now, what's interesting is what David Cameron has said, that he reviewed the most recent legal advice about the situation on the ground, but this left the UK's position on export licenses unchanged. Now, if there's legal advice that the situation on the ground was reviewed, doesn't that mean that they also reviewed the fact that over 33,000 Palestinians have been killed, which equals to a genocide, and then they made a decision to make that announcement?
The British government are just making excuses. The truth is that they want to continue to help Israel with its bombing because they share 100% the Israeli objective of crushing the Palestine resistance. The government are, however, under some pressure because of the legal situation. It would be against British law to supply arms to a country that was committing genocide. And therefore, the government are reluctant to reveal the legal advice that they are receiving, because a child can see that a genocide is going on, and therefore the British government are just trying to hide the truth.
Well, let's break this down a little bit further, Mick Napier. Sorry about the mix-up there. In terms of this statement by David Cameron, he says that based on legal advice, the UK is acting within international law. Now, trying to wrap our head around that, when you have the ICJ, the UN, like the UN Special Rapporteur for the Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, and a host of other organizations that I'm sure you're more familiar with, have said that what is taking place is a genocide, then how could the UK... I don't know if I should ask you how the UK could be acting within international law, or how could David Cameron have the courage to come out and say that?
I think the word is not courage, it's shamelessness. I mean, the British government, this is not the first time they've backed a genocidal regime. Margaret Thatcher famously appeared on television at a time when Britain and America were backing the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia against the Vietnamese installed government to say that there was a faction of the Khmer Rouge, the moderates, with whom Britain could work. So if you can work with the Khmer Rouge, you can work with Netanyahu to try to exterminate tens and tens of thousands of Palestinians. No, this is the infinitely elastic British government concept of international law, where international law extends to the obvious violation of international law. Look, the Genocide Convention is unlike any other. It absolutely enjoins and demands that all the affiliated governments, all the governments that endorse the convention, must take every available means within their power to stop a genocide starting or to bring it to an end as quickly as possible. But we see, for example, the main government, could I say, in Yemen, taking practical action in support of Palestine, in support of Gaza, trying to interdict Israeli supply lines to come to the aid of the people in Gaza under genocide. But Britain and America bomb them. So it's not just that they are turning a blind eye to international law. They're violating any conceivable concept of international law. Because once again, the ICJ has said that there is a plausible case for genocide against Israel. That means it's likely or probable or very, very much on the cards. Once that's in the frame, then it's quite clear the British government and the Americans are utterly opposed to any vestige of international law. And you know, one of the Christian spokesmen in Jerusalem made the point recently. Whenever Britain and America ever raise their voices to talk about human rights, you don't need a detailed lawyer to respond. You just have to say Gaza. And that means that everything they say should not be taken, nothing they say should be taken seriously in that area from now on. So I think that the fact that Cameron is continuing to send the weapons really means they're paying a very high price in terms of isolation. In terms of big millions and millions of people around the world deciding never to believe another word the British government says. Now, we know about perfidious Albion. I don't want to cast any aspersions on your other guest, an ex-ambassador, but we know that Britain is a byword for dishonesty in the field of diplomacy. But now to say that this is despite hundreds of lawyers, including High Court judges, who've just written a letter recently saying that Britain is very likely in breach of international law. Cameron digs in, but nobody believes him. I don't even think he believes himself.
Well, taking a look at the U.S., the other major country, if not at the top of the list, Peter Ford, you know, it's really interesting how they come about and make their case when it comes to, you know, first of all, there's not a genocide that's taking place. This is what the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has said. He has also said that and acknowledged that 25,000 women and children have been killed in this genocide. He didn't call it a genocide, of course. And then you have Israel also, probably around 100, or maybe even more at this point, of what's called these licenses, where it doesn't hit the threshold or it doesn't hit that maximum dollar amount that's required for an announcement. And it is said about 100 of those have been at this point executed, with arms being sent to Israel, which a lot of it is consisted of bombs. Do you think the U.S. is trying to deceive its arms deliveries to the Israeli regime by doing that, in terms of not getting to that dollar amount?
Well, the American and British governments pay lip service only to international law. They insist that other countries follow international law, but as far as they're concerned, it does not apply to themselves or to their puppet, Israel. This is the basic truth of the matter. And they employ scores of lawyers who provide them with legal excuses to continue flouting international law. And sadly, the world is a jungle. Nobody is going to force a country to apply international law, except the main villains themselves, the US and the UK, attempt sometimes to force other countries to respect international law. But there is nobody, certainly not the International Court of Justice, or the ICC, the International Criminal Court, which has the power to bring these two accomplices in crime to book. That is the sad fact. And so the British take refuge behind the excuse that the assessment that they carried out of whether Israel was committing war crimes predated the judgment, the interim judgment, by the ICJ. And we will all have to wait until the next assessment, which may be some months down the track, before it becomes clear what the British position is. It's a farce.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
When you take a look at the way international conventions and laws have been broken, maybe it's quite unprecedented, Mick Napier, if you take a look at what has happened when it comes to this genocidal war. And in particular, one day, April 1st, actually, where Israel broke two international conventions three times in one day. It started out with the Al-Shifa genocide, where the revelations came out about hundreds of bodies being discovered. It was 400 and plus that were reported. And then it came that attack, a terrorist act that Iran called on its consular building in Syria. And then you had the aid workers that were also killed, all in one day. Isn't that a mockery of just any type of law that Israel is making, is breaking all norms when it comes to that?
Yes, and I share Peter Ford's analysis that this is a mockery. I mean, this has been a long time coming. Israel has never felt bound by any notion of international law whatsoever. It considers itself to be exceptional. I mean, one notable example reported of the Israeli cabinet is that when Israel invaded an Arab capital in 1982, Lebanon, in Beirut, when a UN delegation visited the city and began to talk about the need for Israel to withdraw, it's reported by member in the Israeli media that there was a touch of humor involved when Israel shelled the center of the city at precisely 2:42 and 3:38 in the afternoon and killed a large number of people with their shells, of course, in order to underline contempt for the United Nations. This was widely understood in Israel. So Israel, for a very long time, has responded to appeals to follow international law by such murderous response and such contempt. Look, there's only one country so far which has been found guilty of terrorism by an international court. And it's no surprise that Nicaragua today is in the middle of a case against Germany for complicity in the genocide. Because Nicaragua took America to, I think it was the ICC, and was supported in a charge against America being guilty of terrorism by mining their harbors, by funding the Contras, by killing literacy workers, teachers, hospital workers, and so on. But a fat lot of good it did them. America simply ignored that finding. Israel again in 2004 was found guilty by the ICJ, and a ruling was given that they had to take down the separation wall, the so-called apartheid wall, which they were building across the whole apartheid. What happened? All the states that were affiliated to the court refused to take any sanctions against Israel, increased their arms sales, and that was why precisely a year to the day in 2005, the Palestinian Civil Society launched an appeal for boycott, divestment, and sanctions to say we have been let down. We've gone to international courts, okay, but no appeal to morality to these governments has any effect. So we need to try something else. So America, Britain, Israel, they always completely disobey international law when it suits them.
Well, maybe that's one of the things that is the basis for the resistance groups in the region, Peter Ford, in particular the Islamic resistance of Iraq, for example, as an example, not to mention Yemen, who are in a sense, taking matters in their own hands when international rule-based order, so to speak, has failed. And they just want this genocidal war to stop. But yet, since it hasn't, they're targeting the occupied Palestine in terms of the Israeli regime. What do you make of the fact that we're looking at this attack, a terrorist act that Iran has called it, on Iran's consular building in Syria? Do you see that, Peter Ford, as a sign where the Israeli regime has failed and has been defeated on the ground in the Gaza Strip and therefore needs to widen the war and picked, I would say, the wrong, I guess, country to pick on, and that's Iran?
Well, the attack on the Iranian consulate was a blatant violation of international law, and specifically the Vienna Convention relating to embassies and consulates. I can tell you as a former diplomat that the Vienna Convention is holy writ is sacred for all diplomats all over the world, because at the end of the day, it's their only protection against violence. And the Israelis broke this convention. And then Britain and the United States not only failed to condemn it, but they prevented the Security Council from issuing a statement condemning the blatant attack. As a result, no diplomat anywhere in the world can feel safe anymore. And the two countries that are supposed to be the biggest supporters of the Vienna Convention and other international laws are, in fact, the biggest breakers of these laws. And as a diplomat, I can tell you it's absolutely shocking. But to anyone who knows how the administrations of the UK and the US work hand in glove with Israel, it's not surprising. Israel has been waging a war on Syria for at least 5 years. Hundreds, literally hundreds of bombings have taken place. The recent attack on the Iranian consulate was not the most serious in terms of victims. But Israel gets away with it because it is given protection by the United States and Britain.
Well, we are looking at another day where there were massive and large-scale protests in solidarity with Palestinians that took place, McNapier. But we're looking at this to have taken place more or less in the past 6 months, and not just over in London or other areas in the UK, but worldwide, really. I mean, like Jordan, consecutive days in a row they've been protesting. What type of impact do you think that has had, whether it's on the political scene or otherwise? The thing that comes to my mind is the boycott, of which these types of protests have really given momentum to the boycott movements, which you could probably tell us how that has panned out.
Well, it's a slow burn, but really the images of the last 6 months have burned so deeply into many, many millions of people's minds that it's impossible to go back to the status quo for many people. Today I was on a demonstration in Glasgow that shut down one branch of Barclays Bank, and then they went to a supermarket and briefly closed that down as well. There's an appetite now in the pro-Palestine solidarity movement to escalate. We saw a million people march through London for Palestine recently. Unprecedented numbers. We've never seen anything like that before. And because the genocide is continuing and people feel particularly impotent and unable to stop it, there is an appetite to escalate. And we saw activists close down the third Israeli arms factory in Britain by Elbit a few weeks ago, and activists are inspired by this and beginning to think that this kind of direct action and mass mobilization together is the only thing that can make a difference. Look, when the word genocide comes into the frame, all etiquette, all protocol is off. I remember during the Rwanda massacre, the Rwanda genocide, of course, the UN general in charge, a man called, I think it was called Romeo Dallaire, because America absolutely refused to use the word genocide because they knew what it entailed, he was absolutely distraught. And later, for a few years, he became an alcoholic, absolutely devastated. But America was determined during that genocide not to allow the word genocide to be used. And it's exactly the same thing with Gaza today. We are facing the reality that the phrase that's trotted by off the lips of Western diplomats, the rules-based international order, millions, hundreds of millions of people now realize there is no rules-based international order. There is no international law. The only way to protect life and to avoid the atrocious suffering is through resistance. Resistance of all kinds against the perpetual war machine that we now see at work in Gaza. forcing a situation of disease and starvation, unspeakable atrocities. And these unspeakable atrocities are an acid eating away at the status quo, and millions of people determined that they cannot continue with this status quo. So I think the having been involved in BDS for a very long time, it doesn't go up gradually. It goes up through a particular massacre. It goes up by step. And I fully anticipate this step to be far and away the greatest step that the boycott and divestment movement is going to take.
All right. You know, when it comes to that, again, back to that attack on Iran's consular building, Peter Ford, if there is going to be any type of military engagement with Iran, which Iran has promised that there's going to be a counter attack, how do you think Israel's going to be able to handle that if we were looking at other groups, resistance groups in the region to also engage Israel militarily? Because we know with Hezbollah, they're engaged on that front. We know that the Islamic Resistance of Iraq, for example, is targeting Israel quite a bit. It's upped the number of attacks in the past 2 weeks especially. I mean, can Israel actually be stretched on so many fronts?
Well, Israel has started a process now which may go beyond what they expected by breaking a taboo, by crossing a red line with the bombing of a diplomatic office. They may have bitten off more than they can chew. Israel is not able, I believe, to sustain a war on two fronts for more than a few days. And if they, in the end, provoke Iran to the extent that a new front is opened up, Israel will suffer very badly. They will not be able to proceed with their plans in Gaza, for one thing. Already, without Iran lifting a finger, we see that the Israelis are panicking. They've already withdrawn a lot of their troops from Gaza. They have put the country on alert. Economic activity in Israel has come to a standstill. Israel is a small country with not a very large population. They are not able to sustain this level of activity, military activity, for very long. And this is before Iran has even lifted a finger. Israel is already paying a heavy price for what they did in Damascus.
Thank you, Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Peter Ford, thank you so much, former British ambassador to Syria.
Welcome.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
مجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. The second point is that I consider the negotiating team, the friends who have shouldered these responsibilities during this time, to be trustworthy, brave, courageous, and religious. Everyone should know this. Many of the participants in this meeting are not aware of the content of the negotiations. If you are aware of the content and details of the negotiations and what happens there, then you would surely confirm part of what I am saying. Besides, I know some of these friends up close, and I know some from their performance record. They are religious, and trustworthy people. Their goal is to further the affairs of the country and to solve problems that they are working on it. They really have a national zeal and courage. They are confronted with a large number of people. I do not want to mention the appropriate description of these people because sometimes there are certain descriptions which some people really deserve, but it is not appropriate for us to present it. They really express their viewpoints and pursue matters in the face of such people with complete courage and with absolute precision.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The third point is about the esteemed critics. I am not against criticism. It is all right to criticize, and it is necessary and helpful. However, everyone should pay attention to that criticizing is easier than taking action. We easily see the other person's flaws while we fail to see the dangers, difficulties, concerns, and problems that he deals with. This is like watching someone who wants to dive into a pool. Imagine that you are standing beside a pool. Someone has gone up and he wants to dive into the pool from a height of 10 meters. You are watching him. He dives into the pool and you, who are watching him beside the pool, say, "Well, he bent his legs and knees. This is one error." Yes, this is an error, but you should climb up the diving board, take a look at the water from that height of 10 meters, and then you should make a judgment. Criticizing is easy. Of course, what I am saying should not prevent you from making criticisms. You can criticize, but you should do so by considering the fact that the other side might be aware of some of the faults that we express in our criticisms. But they have reached this conclusion anyway, because of necessity or another reason.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.